Okay, so today is the end of day two at the permaculture design course. We're in Dayton, Montana. Today I think the main topic of the whole day was the ethics and principles. And yesterday was mostly like introductions and, you know, stuff about getting together, you know, like how to get this everything to work and, you know, don't stab people, that's bad. Did they say that? I can't remember. That's important. Don't stab people. But so I'm here with
George
and Mike.
All right, so I had to go do a big gob of stuff. Oh, and here comes Kelly. Kelly's here.
Hi, Kelly. Where in?
I had to leave for a big slice of the day. So you guys are talking about ethics and principles, and there's probably some people out there that think that I probably shouldn't have skipped this day, that I probably should have been here for this day. But I don't know. So you guys tell me what were the highlights of the day? Anybody?
Well, I tell you, I like Mollison's quotes. He gave us a couple. Permaculture, the rearrangement of nothing new into more beneficial relationships. I think America could use a little bit more rearranging of nothing new, because we got lots of junk that if we rearrange it, it could do good things.
Peter was talking about creating a bit of paradise where you live, and that permaculture is a conduit for the indigenous cultures worldwide, the old times and the new times. The cutting edge meets the ancient past.
You got one, George? You got anything?
I didn't take any notes or quotes, but my highlight of the day was the practicum. Observation, which is principle number one from Allison. And that was quite something. The instruction was, I think, sort of very poetic, because we had to learn how to use our senses. One of the practices I also suggested that we use our noses, but in going out and sort of surveying land and starting to see, we have to hear and smell and use peripheral vision and everything else to sort of just take in what's out there. And to me, what was interesting was that, in fact, when I went out, I began to see things all the way up in the summit. It was quite interesting how this incessant wind that is really a problem today was truly so buffered by two small gullies up on the mountain that you know clearly showed a pattern where plant life was different, and as a result of that, the insect density and the hunting birds confirmed how very very different it can be in a landscape that is otherwise so seemingly uniform.
Now, when I took this PDC 7 years ago, there was a thing that we did, and maybe you just said that you did that thing, and so let me just verify, and that was when Skeeter said, okay, everybody take a piece of paper and a pencil, mm-hmm. and you all got to get as far away from each other as you can,
yep.
and then you park,
yeah.
and you write down everything you see, and then we're going to reconvene, and, you know, that kind of thing. So you yeah. did do that.
Right.
See,
right.
Now, 7 years ago, when I did that, and I'm heading out, my thoughts in my head were, this is the stupidest thing yet. Yeah. and then I got there and I sat down, and about 3 minutes into it, it's like, this is the coolest thing ever. And it's like, whoa, what the hell happened? It's like, I was so sure this is going to be dumb, and yet all I'm doing is sitting here and writing down stuff, and it's like, it turned out to be super cool. So now, was I the only guy that had that feeling?
No, I don't think you were at all. Take time to smell the roses. That there's some real meaning to that. The intricacies of what I saw, and I spent a lot of my professional life at one time outdoors, being paid to observe and take note and knowing some things about nature. You never stop. You never stop seeing new stuff. It was very interesting. just watching the birds interact with one another and knowing, okay, I'm not interfering, let's just see what these characters do, was you always come up with more questions than answers. Okay, they did that, now why did they just do that? As I was telling George, I found a fern. I mean, I know it was a fern. I know yarrow from ferns, and I've seen this kind of fern a couple other places in the Rockies, one way down in Casper Mountain, where I used to live, north face of the mountain. Very rarely do you find ferns in the drier side of the Rockies. It just doesn't happen. So I just thought, here in this little micro niche that I'll bet the next 99 people would walk by and never notice, is this little plant just doing its plant thing, eking out a living in the crack between two rocks. It's got just enough shelter from the wind, collects just a little bit extra moisture. Nature's full of that. And we dart. Problem is, we just charge through like the bull in the china shop and don't see it.
I putzed around through the wetlands, and I loved where I could step on earth, which was upheld by the roots of those larger trees or bushes. And I found a place where I could sit down, and I laid down in the sun. I was listening to the wind just swirling around the whole valley. And then I heard this clack, 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 like a breaking of a nut or something, and I couldn't figure it out. I turned my head, and I looked right into the face of an owl, which was so cool, and it was actually chomping on its beak to get mad at another person who was checking out the nest of little owlets that was nearby. So I got to see it.
And that's the thing that you did for today's little deal.
Yeah,
today's little outing.
And I was so excited to see an owl because I've been wanting to see a small owl, but he had a big wingspan, and it was so cool.
So, coming back to you a minute. For most, the instruction that you suspend thinking and soak into your senses of what surrounds you probably ordinarily feels very, very stupid. You know, professionally for me it's not, because this is what I do for a living. You basically
Dr. George.
Being a psychoanalyst, just shut down your thinking and take in something that's out there and suspend your judgment. But in ordinary life it's an unusual way to go out and soak in nature.
It's like instead of doing all the time, you get to receive the gift of nature.
True.
Yeah, we're always weighing and balancing all the input with okay, why am I here, what am I really supposed to be doing, and it's just because you're constantly filtering through all these judgments and experiences, instead of just go out there and be a sponge. I mean, really take it in. Most of us just don't do that very often. And it makes sense in the, you know, we're not just here on some new age la-la trip, which is not what this is about. It's if we learn to observe closely, we can see what happens in our systems and change them, modify them, add to them as the design begins to mature. But you gotta learn to look closely, pay attention to what's actually going on.
So now when I did it, my thinking was is that if I just came out there and was just sitting there, my mind would probably wander off onto something else. But the fact that I was, so as part of the exercise, which made it, you know, expose the value to me, was the idea to fill a page with description of what you can see from sitting in one spot.
Sure.
And so I remember that there were ants, and I remember that there were, I think I could recognize five or six different species of plants, and I noticed a couple of birds, and I noticed the soil had a certain level of damp. But it's like by writing these things down, that somehow I felt like I was being 20 times the observer than as if I was just sitting out there and observing without the writing it down. That was my own analysis, my own self-analysis. Does anybody else kind of can confirm or deny? Or
we didn't have to write anything down, but we still had such a level of observation and discovery. So we were looking at the micro and the macro, and there's so much life happening, especially on the micro, on every level, that when Peter went through the ethics of permaculture, which is care of the earth, care of people, fair share, that care of the earth takes on a whole different dimension that you learn to be so much more careful about when you really are able to observe the macro and the micro and the multiple levels of life on all of those levels.
So then that leads into the three ethics. And we've had some challenges at permies.com with the three ethics, and there's a lot of people that have a lot of different interpretations of what my words are on the three ethics.
And that makes sense. sense, you know, we're always, there's always filtered through who you are, what your experiences are.
It's true. It's true. So I think there's really no objection with the first two, which is going to be care of the earth, care of the people. But now the third ethic has changed and morphed a lot. Did you guys talk about that today?
We just briefly mentioned it, and like he brought up the Mondragon cooperatives where the CEO can't make more than about four times the amount that a janitor makes. So it's kind of trying to get towards a fair share for wages. It doesn't mean everybody's equal, but it just means fair.
So now I saw something yesterday where it was a quote from Mollison that was part of the course here, and Mollison was saying that there's, you know, care of the earth, care of people, and then the return of surplus to those two, and that was the third ethic. Now, of course, the original third ethic had something to do with population control, and then it morphed into a couple of different things, and then apparently the fair share was never one of Mollison's. Mollison never said that.
Sort of an interpretation of you know, someone else's words.
So I think Jeff Lawton said that was something that was like somebody found this cute way of saying this, and they thought it rhymed. Because it rhymed, they threw it in there, and then somehow it stuck.
Yeah.
And it's been problematic ever since. But now, is fair share what they were teaching today, or was it something else?
He mentioned also just reinvesting back into the system.
Yeah, I really want to.
Okay.
And I'm looking at the handout here. This apparently is from Holmgren. Redistribute the surplus. That's maybe a really good way to look at it.
Right.
You have a surplus. We should be able to make it, or work to make it fair, not only between people, the people care, but, you know, if I produce too much of something, I shouldn't really bellyache if the birds come and take a whack at it. After all, I enjoy the heck out of seeing them on my place or out here on these hills. It doesn't matter. Well, guess what? You want to enjoy them? They've got to be fed.
Yeah, true. Bait.
Yeah.
George, you got anything on this one?
Well, I was always wondering if redistribution was on many different levels interpreted idiosyncratically. And so fair share maybe is a cautious way to diffuse the potential misinterpretation. And fair share can be seen in many, many different ways. I mean, redistribution has a you know, a clearly sort of easily politicized connotation.
Yeah.
It brings in socialism, even worse, communism, where with its forced need to give away what you possess. And of course, Churchill comes to mind, who said that capitalism is an uneven and unfair distributional system, while socialism is an equal redistributional, much less.
So then earlier today, somebody brought that up, and I was kind of thinking like, oh, okay, I want to make sure I don't get any politics into my podcast, but just you know, taking a quick little thing into it. Most of these systems we talk about, you know, socialism, capitalism, etc. It's kind of like they each can sing and they can each be awful, and I think that the key is that when you add in the ickiness to any of them, they any of them will suck. And so I think, and then if you take away the icky and you know, if everybody's into having them be good, then they'll all, any of them can work and be good. And but anyway, I think that the key is like we you guys talked about the ethics. And I do think that one of you know, the challenges that I always talk about is like, well, if Monsanto were to sing the same song, would they change their ways? And then the podcast that I did with Toby Hemingway, Toby knows some of the people in Monsanto, and he was saying, no, they would do what they continue to do, what they do now, and they would sing the song, and they would believe it. They would believe it to the core that they're doing all the things. They're redistributing the surplus. They're doing fair share. That they're care of the people and care of the earth so much better than anybody else. They would believe it. And so, anyway, so Kelly's about to pop. She's got so much to say. All right, Kelly.
Well, I just, you know, I think that we skip over the people care a lot, which is education, culture of accountability, care of elders, creative expression, reskilling, lots of other things, you know, getting down to eco-villages. So I think that when we really take into account care of the earth, care of the people, then the third thing, which whatever it is, the third ethic is, you know, is going to be pretty obvious. So it's basically a way to function that is just common sense, which is really not the way any of the political systems up to date function.
Right. I remember one of Mollison's quotes from yesterday is that permaculture is definitely not political. You know, and so it's kind of like, let's talk about what we can do within our communities, within our land, and leave the politics out. But okay, so then the principles. You guys went into principles, and so what was singing for you today in the world of principles? Anybody?
Sector design zone.
Pretty vague. No one's got a clear. Not a clear winner.
We did do a lot of principles.
Well, and of course I missed some of the principles because I had kitchen duty, but the sector stuff. You know what it boils down to? Since we're looking at permaculture as a set of design skills, not really rules, again, because it's principles, there's give and space to interpret. But the whole idea there is consider all the possibilities before you go do something, and that is exactly what we do not do in America. I mean, I buy this land, and by golly, this is what I'm going to do with it. You know, I'm going to plow I'm going to flatten every tree, and I'm going to build houses on myself because this is my land and I can do it. Doesn't matter, you know, if you're going to screw up half the watershed and just dump mud on everybody downstream, because by golly, that's my right. You know, if we would take half the consideration that we talked about today of water pollution, how animals use the land, fire, oh, hey, that's not any problem in the West, is it now, Paul? You know, I'm a native of Southern California, and I just get a kick out of when the big fires come, and they come almost every year, and there's all the hand-wringing, and isn't this horrible? Well, yeah, it's horrible, but hold on, folks. You build up in the chaparral, and now you're shocked that you've got problems with fire and everybody's house burns down? Well, golly, you know, you couldn't come up with this sooner? Brilliant. You know, you build on floodplains, and then we all wring our hands about, oh, yeah, the floods this last year on the Missouri. And we've got a nuclear power plant right outside of Omaha, and the darn thing's surrounded by floodwater for, what, 3 months, 4 months? Wow, we really had our thinking caps on that one, too. I know you need water for cooling, but, you know, you might not want to build it quite so close to the river. Hello? You know, things like that. And the sector analysis part of it, which I did come back in on after a delicious lunch. Just, folks, look at all the angles and come up with your best design based on some of this.
So I want to say that I think that while it's true, there's a lot of farmers out there that are like, they think that they've got it figured out, and then they're doing some stuff that's pretty destructive, and they're kind of apathetic. But at the same time, I think there's a lot of people that are waving the permaculture flag that go out there and they think that they've got it all figured out, and they are also doing something that's destructive, but it's a different flavor of destructive, and I think that there's a lot to be said for the learning curve, and I just kind of feel like I feel that if I stand up and if I were to condemn those farmers that are making such a big mess too severely, then I feel like I will then be doomed to be that person. And so I'm a little worried, you know, in that space. But now, as far as like, I also think that part of homesteading with permaculture and whatnot, part of that is going to be to make some mistakes. When I first did chickens, I felt like I was, you know, doing the right thing because I gave them such a big run. And then as time passed, I was feeling like like, and I watched and I observed and I kind of thought, you know, I want there to be a better way. And then I ended up coming to the solution of the paddock shift system without knowing that anyone else was doing paddock shift with chickens. And then later I learned that there were lots of people that came to the same conclusion after I wrote my article on the chickens. So it's kind of like I kind of want to leave room. And then you know what? Even if we do Sepp Holzer stuff, even Sepp Holzer, I kind of wonder if 20 years from now we're going to learn that the Sepp Holzer stuff is kind of lame compared to, you know, Bob Smith or something like that. So it's like, you know, I want to, when I wrote the HUSP stuff, I was kind of thinking like, I want to learn the stuff that's way beyond what we all know right now. So I don't know how I got onto this tangent. Oh, George knows.
I don't know how you got on the tangent, but I have a few things to say about the principles, whether it's 12 or 15. I've been teaching psychiatry for a long time, and one of the ways I'm trying to help those who are learning a new system is to explain that these system of principles is like the blankie for the kid. In other words, when we learn a system of principles, a way of thinking in new ways about the world, needs to be sort of formally taught and repeated, just like as the kid uses the blankie, you know, feeling anxious without mommy. And the blankie will represent something that is both belonging to the toddler and mom, and eventually becomes part of the way to live in the world safely with mom internalized. So the system becomes you. So as the principles are reviewed over and over and over again, it becomes a way for you to think about what you do. And so when you say that you have made mistakes, in fact, one of the principles is that the problem is the solution, and that you have to accept feedback. In other words, you know, modern learning theory is also based on that very idea that the way that you learn is that you make mistakes. In other words, the mistake is not only inevitable, but that's the way of learn new ways about the world, because it's not that they are trying to teach us how to go about doing you know, homesteading or farming. It's a way to think in a new way about how to approach it.
So just moments ago, I was talking to somebody just like just before we started the podcast, and I shared Thompson's rule for first-time telescope makers, which effectively is saying exactly what you just said. Thompson's rule for first-time telescope makers says this: it is faster to build a 4-inch mirror and then a 6-inch mirror than to build a 6-inch mirror. So I think that the message in that is that I want to end up with a 6-inch mirror. However, because I know I will make mistakes, I will start with a 4-inch mirror and learn lessons, which will then make it so that it's easier to build a 6-inch mirror.
Right.
Kelly's got something.
Well, we also are dealing with time. We all feel pressed for time. You know, is the world going to shift or change? Or we have a certain amount of years that we have in being productive in a piece of land. And these principles really help us to sort of take that time, make the slow, small changes. And it's great to review the permaculture principles, which you can find online. And then it goes into care of the earth. A lot of times people think permaculture is just about gardening, but it's about reversing damage, creating habitat for animals, harvesting water, eliminating waste, building soil, returning what you take, taking your place and turning it green, you know, reforestation, toxic cleanup, bio and myco, which is mycelium fungi, remediation, biodiversity, carbon sequestration. And so all these different things, gray water systems, there are so many aspects of permaculture which need to be looked at, and it can you delve into any one of those and you become kind of good at it. It's so diverse. So there are so many ways in the earth care, the people care, and the principles are just a great way to sort of peacefully be able to tackle all of this.
So the blankie gives you a foundation that you can go back to, and see that's. I mean, would the ethics be part of that too? The ethics and the principles?
Sure. The principles more so than the ethics. The ethics is fairly straightforward, I think.
Yeah, I think. Be nice, don't stab people.
Yeah. But the principles, I think for the most part, contain a fairly sort of modern message.
When I reread the principles now, I don't see them so much as like I am going to super glue myself to these. I look at them more as like thought experiments. Like
makes sense.
When I look at them, I think of them as like this is something that I can run through my brain and exercise my brain with these. How do these apply? How could the same statement be used for abuse, as well as how could the same statement be used to like do better at whatever it is I'm doing?
Yeah.
Is that fair?
Yeah, and I was thinking as you had your kind of last monologue, humility in all of this. I think we all need to exercise a great deal of humility. The world we live in is so much bigger than we are, and we're only a part. Now, we are a very influential part, but to consider that we are the end-all, be-all, know-all is just, that's the ultimate hubris. That's just so arrogant. And that's where we end up in such a mess.
I think the magic phrases that help are make the best of it. I think that's Garrison Keillor. I could be quoting Garrison Keillor. Make the best of it. Another one was try and improve.
Yeah, learn from those mistakes. And like what Kelly just shared, it's not like those are all discrete little pieces that through a design, a conscious design on our parts, we can put a lot of those pieces together in one,
right?
In on your land, on our land, whatever, in a community. It's not like you have to consider all those. Well, we need to sequester carbon, and we need to do that. They're not separate things. If you're building soil, you're sequestering carbon. If you're building soil, you're increasing fertility, and on down the line. I mean, this is a lot of this is ecology 101.
You're favoring the broader, because the principles are going to cover broader things. Like we could talk about planting peas,
right?
But there's a broader message with each of the principles, and you're finding that those broader messages provide the scaffolding for the more detailed ideas that are about to come in the course.
Right.
We did start with that. We started talking about zones, how basically zone one, things you do every day, without getting your slippers wet, ideally, and compost, the flow of your house. Where does your compost go? Your chickens and your eggs and your stuff you eat every day. And then the zone two for things that you dinner.
Yes, dinner time.
So, and then zone two, things you visit maybe once a week, then once a month for zone three, and then getting out to zone five are the things you don't touch, where you leave the wild. And then she got into seeing what the needs and the yields are from anything in a system, be it a kitchen or a chicken or whatever. You find out what their needs are, what the yields are going to be, and how to find flow with all these different elements. Skeeter talked a lot about slope, how cold air might go and push warm air up higher, or cold air sink. How to design, start taking in these elements, be it wind, how to block wind, how to capture sun, with hedges and windrows and things like that. So we started talking about design in detail.
Yeah, there's some details in that for sure.
Okay. So now, I came in here towards the end, and you guys were talking about patterns a little bit, and I kind of want to convey a couple of things about, I feel like patterns, when it comes to patterns in permaculture, every time I read it, every time I try to digest it, I feel like I get lost. I must be stupid is what I feel like. I must not get it. I must not have the mental capacity to be able to.
Well, that makes two of us then. Good. Well, you're not alone. Okay.
No, I'm not alone. However, I can tell you this, that in the world of software engineering, I was one of the earlier groups that embraced patterns. So start with the architecture stuff. Then there's a book out there about patterns that was in architecture stuff. And then in software engineering, we had what we called the Gang of Four book. It was a book called Design Patterns, and it was for software engineering. And the idea is, when it originally came out, it was was common. It was the idea was to describe common problems in software engineering or common challenges in software engineering, and the recognized best practice solution. And that's how it was presented. And there were 23 patterns in this book with examples. In the beginning, it was awesome because we could see the patterns and the things that we were doing and the common problems, and now we had this vocabulary for talking about them and being able to have common solutions. And then shortly after that, it turned into a disaster because then engineers were like, okay, if I'm trying to do something and I don't have one of these patterns, then I must be doing it wrong. And so a lot of them would then try and say, I wonder if I can squeeze in 7 of these patterns instead of just 2 in what I'm doing. And it'll be better, right? Because it has more patterns. And so disaster after disaster after disaster. The thing that I ended up doing was to say that the thing that the software engineers should shoot for is do the simplest thing that can possibly work. That's leading the path there. And then patterns are to be used for vocabulary and helping to convey ideas only. That you should not try to be saying, I need to implement the so-and-so pattern in my...
Not hard and fast.
No. Do the simplest thing can possibly work trumps everything. And then the dominant... the use of patterns for just so that I can talk to you and I can tell you what I'm thinking of. I'm thinking of this and I'm thinking of that. So here's some words I can use to help so we can communicate. To me, that was the greatest value of patterns. That doesn't seem to really apply here because we could talk about, oh, there's a spiral and there's a web and there's a, this other thing. And it's like, okay, we could have some of that. But it's like, well, and when we're going to try and design this thing, maybe we want to have some webbiness or some spiral or some lobe or whatever. Maybe we could do something. Maybe that helps with, so that when I'm talking about what I'm about to go and do, then I can mention these patterns. But they seem to be more like the patterns like we're talking about here. I mean, biomimicry, I think, is something that's worth talking about, which I'm still very weak on, although there's a couple of examples that I've seen that have been really awesome. But I kind of think that a lot of the patterns that we talked about today, I think, probably have a lot more weight in the world of art. Now, granted, these are patterns of artistic pattern, like a spiral is an artistic pattern. I kind of wonder about, other patterns that, like edge, I think is a good pattern, but it's actually a principle. Edge is a principle.
Right, and any of these patterns create edge, so what creates the most advantageous edge for your design for that particular piece of the world?
It may not work at all on what I'm dealing with at all.
So a great example. So spiral was one of the things that we saw today as a pattern, and so I'm here to tell you that if you're going to try and do a hugel culture in a spiral, that sucks. That's
good luck.
Stupid. Man, you don't have a hose long enough, okay? You're thinking, man, I got to get something in there. It's like, I just made it so that it's a 4-mile hike to do anything, so everything is as far away as possible. It's like not really a great idea mixing hugel culture with spiral. So George had something.
Occam's razor. You have to use the simplest principle and the simplest design possibly you can in any situation.
I would have to say that that's typically, for most of our endeavors, that is typically the case. And then yet at the same time, I would have to say that the opposite would be the case for certain forms of recreation or relaxation or goofing off. I want to find the longest, I want to take a different path than the most efficient because it's more luxurious. I don't know, possibly.
Allows you more chance to observe, like we talked earlier.
Right, possibly that. And so,
I thought it was really funny because I studied permaculture so long ago that when I would start to install gardens, I'd try to pull hoses through spirals or pull hoses, and it doesn't work. I mean, the straight line is the thing. But if you're going to design for systems that maybe don't need hoses, then you can start to play with capturing airflow or whatever. But like I was thinking about, gosh, I want to start developing my waterfall into my fish pond in the spiral that will oxygenate the water better. So there are uses for for these patterns if they can maximize what nature's doing. There's a lot of, you know, wind currents that if you can do a keyhole bed, it's going to be better for your plants to either capture more sun or to block the wind than to do a straight line. But really, these are systems that are going to have to be designed in ways that are truly permaculture, doing more alternative irrigation systems other than pulling hoses, which is very frustrating.
So while I was gone and when points were brought up, was there a lot of people saying, well, Paul would say,
sorry, no, you got your kudos last night.
That's right.
For those who were not, of course, here, they asked us how we found out about this workshop, or this PDC. And I think Paul got about a 60% rating. About 60% of people said we
were. I was thinking it was about, so there's 45 people. I think it was about 40 out of 45.
Now, see, look who was counting.
I was guessing. Well,
how did we find out about it?
Find out about it from me.
And I was the first one. Remember, I even pointed the fickle finger at you and said, I blame it on Wheaton.
I like the one
I've never met him before yesterday.
I like the one where the person said something about world domination.
I'm excited to know that we'll have very many more really successful PDCs in the future because everybody will find out and they'll come.
Right. And so we're getting better at that. I think that there's a lot to be said for like helping people to be, I mean, I think the main reason why there have been PDCs that have been canceled due to not enough people signing up isn't because it's like there's not people that are not interested. I think it's just that they're not aware of it. They just didn't know that it was going on.
You were announcing this way back last fall. I think it was in November.
Right. And, a long time ago.
And early November at that.
I think it was last summer.
It could have been.
October was opened up for registration.
Okay. Yeah.
That's when we signed up.
Yeah. Well, that's pretty good lead time, you know, and that's what a lot of folks need, to take 2 weeks off. That's a big big bite out of your life.
So Skeeter is the master at pulling together an event like, you know, a month and a half before it actually starts, and then every time Skeeter asks me to be involved in an event and help, I say, can we get more lead time? You know, can we? You know, it'd be great if we have a year of lead time. He has such great success with just a month and a half. It's kind of like it's hard for me to put my argument forward.
No, and you look at what they've accomplished in the 2 days before we came here and all the buildings and structures they put up. Fantastic.
Right. We're at a farm. Well, it's not actually a functioning farm. And they have 95 acres here. They have land. They have horses here. But it's just a house and a bunch of acreage. And they've built, like, what is this, like 7 little temporary buildings?
Some of these aren't so temporary. I believe they're going to stay, at least the frames are, after we're gone for future gatherings of whatever nature it might be.
Yeah. This is pretty amazing to throw together something so quickly.
I mean, you know, this thing
felt like a rocket.
The wind was nasty, and it wasn't the frame that was making the noise. It was just the tarp coverings.
Right.
This is a great job.
Yeah. So I think a lot of PDCs are offered on land where there's not really the facilities for a PDC, and they throw something together like this. My favorite part, I mean, granted, there's a lot of structures here and stuff like that. My favorite part for this PDC is in the classroom, in this huge classroom, which could hold a lot more people than what we have here. The key is that they brought in a whole bunch of couches. And so that was you doing that, Kelly?
Oh, yeah. We've got this dump next to our house. We call it the 24/7. And a lot of these couches had been sitting there for maybe a day, and I picked them up. Perfectly good recliners. We got this set that had been recovered 4 times. The family was just tired of it. And, you know, just really cool stuff. You know, a handle broken here and there. But it's good. It's coming together. We had 50 people comfortably in here. It looks like there's going to be 100 people when Seth gets here for a few days, and then a few people will leave. And can I tell a little secret?
Well, this is a recording device, but the podcast probably won't go out until after Seth's gone.
Well, there is a place that is a beautiful place just north of here, about a half hour, that wants to do a PDC in August 15th. So it might be in the works for the future.
So there might be another one this year.
Yeah, Montana.
In Montana. Wow.
And we would know that Paul Wheaton would be an integral part of the teachers.
Oh, good, good.
Him up now.
Yeah,
oh,
yeah.
A lot of Rocky Mountain heaters and.
Well, now I know that it's in August is when we're doing the big tour. We're doing the big permaculture tour, and so it's late August that we're heading out. But I've got a speaking gig already lined up for like August 17th or something in the Seattle area, and so and maybe I should like find out the actual date and announce it properly.
Okay.
So
we'll work on it. There is another one that people have asked us to put one on, so it's coming.
Yeah, lead time. And another thing that I heard from somebody else just before coming up to this one is that they very much want to take a PDC, but it's like they really can't consider any PDCs that are in the spring or summer or fall because they've got so much farm work to do. But, you know, they can only consider PDCs in the middle of winter.
We can always go to the property in Hawaii.
There is that. All right, what have I left out for the things for today?
Yeah.
Or yesterday, even? Anybody?
No, I think you pretty well. We've pretty
done.
Well covered. Good.
Yeah. And dinner's on, so I'm keeping you guys from dinner. So if you like this sort of thing, come on out to the forums at permies.com where we talk about PDCs, homesteading, and permaculture all the time.
Woohoo!